This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com.
Good evening, everyone. It is Wednesday, February 27th, 2013, and really excited for tonight's topic of current Jewish questions on biblical criticism. Want to actually start off with a little joke. By an actual happenstance. I was in Grus, Yus Kolel in Israel, as part of Smicha, 2001 to 2002. And Simchas Torah, people are going around singing Torah Tashem Tamima, you know, Torah Tashem Tamima, right? And my chavrusa, you know, knows me, like, you know, sort of ribbing me, saying, "Josh, what? How can you sing along? What do you mean? Well, knowing what you know about biblical criticism, how can you say Torah Tashem Tamima?" Thought for a second, I said, "Finish off the pasuk." "What do you mean?" It says, "Edut Hashem ne'emana machkimat peti," that the testimony of God is trustworthy, it makes fools wise. He said, given the number of idiots who study the book that we have, it's proof it's not from God. Because it's just clearly not pulling its weight. So I joke, like, that's the, you know, thing that proves biblical criticism. But the truth is, it's a pretty difficult and super duper controversial topic. Even amongst modern Orthodox Jews, very few people will tackle it head on because of the implications, and we see some of it in this in the class here. Even my father said, when I was, you know, told him I was going to give this class, he said, "Be careful." Because one thing out of line, and before you know it, people stop counting you in Minyan. And we're going to address that. We're, you know, going to address a lot of things that involved here. What should be, and I included at the very beginning, just a very brief summary, courtesy of Wikipedia, of the documentary hypothesis, which really forms the foundation of most modern-day biblical criticism. Julius Wellhausen's contribution, reading from the Wikipedia, was to order the sources chronologically as JEDP, giving them coherent setting in the evolving religious history of Israel, which he saw as one of ever-increasing priestly power. And his formulation was J was written in 950 BC in the northern kingdom, in the southern kingdom of Judah. E was written in 850 BC in the northern kingdom of Israel. D, Deuteronomus, was written in 600 BC in Jerusalem during a period of religious reform. And P, the priestly tradition, was in 500 BC by Kohanim, Jewish priests, in exile in Babylon. The field has moved considerably since Wellhausen, and it also existed before him. He, in fact, took a lot of research that was done before him, and, you know, he compiled it, and he gets a lot of the credit. And many of his predecessors are pretty much ignored unless you're actually, you know, holding in it. We're not going to spend too much time on the depths of biblical criticism for a couple of reasons. One, the literature since Wellhausen is vast. And the field has progressed so far since Wellhausen. Two, you can't really evaluate, you know, the merits or demerits of biblical criticism unless you actually spend a lot of time studying every related field. So, for example, language is huge, and the evolution of the Hebrew language. Now, most people don't like studying Hebrew grammar because they find it boring. And even if you find Hebrew grammar interesting and biblical Hebrew interesting, studying all of the related languages like Ugaritic and Akkadian are significantly more difficult. And, you know, that poses, so it's going to be hard. You can't really argue against biblical criticism unless you actually know what's being argued. So that's not really going to be the point of the class of turn, but more of how do you handle something like biblical criticism in whatever form it is, because if you go to, you know, a university lecture, whatever Bible stuff you're going to do is going to assume the documentary hypothesis or biblical criticism, or if not the documentary hypothesis in this form, certainly the negation of the, let's say, the traditional, perhaps the fundamentalist approach to the Bible, which is God wrote the Bible, or, you know, God gave the Bible through Moses, right? That's pretty straightforward for, you know, traditional slash fundamentalist perspective. I might alternate with those terms. With fundamentalist, I mean more of a strictly saying, here's what it has to be. And whereas we'll see later on, there could be some, you know, distinctions between being traditional without being fundamentalist, and what are some solutions to harmonizing. But first, we have to understand what's going on, some of the difficulties behind it, what are some attempted solutions. It cannot be comprehensive for logical reasons. And the reason why it's, you know, current, you know, because this is current Jewish questions, even though, you know, we've been fighting this for, I shouldn't say fighting this, because the discussion has been going around since, you know, at least Wellhausen or earlier, is because recently there was a bit of a kerfuffle in Canada, of all places. Rabbi Martin Lakshin, a professor, gave a favorable review in the Canadian Jewish News on this book by Norman Solomon Torah from Heaven, The Reconstruction of Faith, which admittedly I have not seen. When I put this together at the YU library, it was out. But the content for our purposes doesn't necessarily matter. We don't even need to read through his review. All that really needs to be said in the first source is that he reviewed it positively. On the other hand, Rabbi N. Daniel Korupkin, I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, wrote in a follow-up editorial, also in the Canadian Jewish News, when Orthodox scholarship is neither, meaning he's saying it's neither Orthodox nor is it scholarship. And he's somewhat critical of, you know, Professor Lakshin's review. And at the end, you know, he says, I am left confused by his by Rabbi Lakshin's review. To his credit, does Rabbi Solomon claim to reconcile his orthodoxy with his newfound belief in the Torah's myth. Indeed, after examining the stated creed of the Movement for Reform Judaism, one concludes that Rabbi Solomon has become a Reform Jew. And that's fine. People change all the time, and he wouldn't be the first Orthodox Jew to leave the fold and become, quote, enlightened, although he is about two centuries too late. But why Rabbi Lakshin feels this book is appropriate for Orthodox Jews with questions is utterly perplexing. This is not a book that will reconcile your orthodoxy with modern scholarship. It rather tells you to reject everything you learned in yeshiva or in yeshiva or seminary's utter drivel, and to reject those Orthodox rabbis who lack wisdom prevents them from seeing the truth. Fortunately, there is a plethora of real scholarship written by Orthodox scholars that proves Rabbi Solomon wrong. It is quite possible and laudable to reconcile one's orthodoxy with one's intellectual skepticism, and it is a project to which I and other rabbis and scholars have dedicated our lives. Now, of course, you know, what you define as a legitimate reconciliation is going to be subjective. For example, if you're going to focus on the if you have the tension between the academic scholarship and the traditional approach, the question is, how far can you deviate from each? Without reading any of his or the contemporaries that he's citing that try to, you know, strive for this reconciliation, you know, the one question you have to ask is, are you in fact traditional enough? Or are you being academic enough? And that goes on both sides. I can also argue that, you know, here when I'm using, you know, Orthodox Judaism, I'm using it in the broadest possible sense, right? Because, I mean, normally I say, like, Orthodox Judaism is a culture. It is quite possible that Orthodox Judaism, or at least a certain type of Orthodox Judaism, will never be able to reconcile any form of biblical criticism if that's the way the culture is defined, where they say, as soon as you mention biblical criticism, or as soon as you mention any Bible scholar that, you know, isn't Rashi, or isn't Jewish, or, you know, as soon as you hold that Rashi doesn't have Ruach HaKodesh, you're automatically a heretic, right? So in that type of Orthodox Judaism, this conversation is already a non-starter. So we're not even talking about questioning, we're talking about just rejecting certain principles as well of how do you define the bounds of Orthodox tradition versus, you know, and how do you define what's considered legitimate scholarship as opposed to apologetics, meaning I could write something like, and the truth is there is a bit of dogma in the academic world too. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Anyway, after this whole thing, you know, came to be, the Vad HaRabbanim of Toronto issued a letter, which is in our source sheet, courtesy of the blogger Dove Bear, who put up the image.
I think I read this.
Well, could you please read it for the record here? I'm trying to see if it's... all right, no, so please. Go ahead. This is, again, from the Vad HaRabbanim of Toronto.
A fundamental principle of our faith is that Torah as we possess it today in its entirety was given to us by Moshe Rabbeinu as it was transmitted to him from God, perhaps as a scribe taking dictation. Halacha rules unequivocally that the denial of the godly origin of even a single word in the Torah or its interpretation as transmitted by tradition in Torah Shabbal Peh contravenes this principle and constitutes kafira ba Torah. The practical halachic implications of this ruling are far-reaching. The suggestion in a recently published article that denial of the aforementioned fundamental principle would not estrange the dissenter from the pale of Orthodox Judaism is fallacious and counterfactual.
Now, whether or not Rabbi Lachshon actually said that is irrelevant. I mean, you could read through his, you know, editorial and see whether... But again, when you're dealing with a certain, you know, fundamentalist type, it isn't going to matter. You know, and so when I read this to someone earlier today, they said, oh, fallacious and counterfactual. Like, why use one word when two would suffice? But, you know, snark aside, you know, halacha rules, name statement. So they're saying this as a matter of psak halacha. Deny godly argument of a single word of the Torah, right, is kfira. And he said the fundamental principle of faith is the Torah, quote, as we possess it today in its entirety. Now, this is a pretty strong statement. Any guesses where he got it from? Without turning the page? One guess. Come on.
Rambam?
There you go. Right? Excellent. So, turning the page over. This is Rambam's introduction to Mishnah, not the Mishnah Torah. In his introduction to Mishnah, in his commentary to Mishnah, but in the introduction to chapter 10 of Sanhedrin. This is where he lays out the 13 principles of faith. If you are unfamiliar with the 13 principles of faith, or even if you are on a cursory level, it's very important to note that the 13 principles you'll find in your siddur, the one plastered on, you know, walls, is not actually Rambam. That's sort of an abbreviation where someone decided to summarize Rambam. Rambam actually writes a great deal more, and when you're dealing with fundamental principles of faith, to the point where you're actually going to throw people in cheirem, you know, excommunicate them, or say what rotten Jews they are, it's probably best to be on the precise side. At any rate, here is the one line or two of the introduction, followed by the eighth principle. Take it, Josh.
Okay. So it is appropriate to mention here, and this is the most appropriate place in this text to mention the following points. The essential beliefs of our sacred Torah and its fundamental principles of faith. The eighth fundamental principle is that the Torah is from heaven, that we should believe that the entire Torah that we possess today is the Torah that was given to Moses, and that it is of godly origin in its entirety. The Torah as a comprehensive whole was granted to Moses by God. The manner in which it was granted to him we call, by analogy, speech. The only one who knows the nature of this process of communication is Moses, the one to whom it was granted. Nevertheless, metaphorically, he can be compared to a scribe taking dictation, writing down all the events that took place, the stories, and the mitzvah. For this reason, it is referred to as the scribe.
Okay. So you can see, based on the language here, that what the Vat of Toronto was effectively doing was paskening Rambam, right, as a matter of halacha. Does anyone have any thoughts with what Rambam said so far? Either in terms of, you know, the argument, what said, any thoughts? If none, I'll throw out some questions, but curious if there are any immediate reactions. Because the operative quote here is that the entire Torah that we possess today, and we're going to go back to that particular point... specifically, it's Shekola Torah Hazo Hanim Tzeit Biyadenu, the one that we happen to have in our hands. And we're going to talk about that in more detail later, because there's a great deal that hinges upon those couple of lines. What do you say about, you know, these laws of belief? What do you think? First off, would you consider this, did he call this a law of belief, or an Ikari Torah Tenu? And this is somewhat of a theological bent here, of what does Rambam mean as a matter of halacha, in terms of what is it that it, as a matter of law, of a matter of belief, right? Because here he uses it as ikare Torah tenu a Torah, which are the essential beliefs of the Torah. Why do I make such a distinction? Because in Hilchot Teshuvah 3:8, he calls certain people kofrim. And here's what he puts it. Three are called kofrim, deniers. And the first one is, the one who says that the Torah is not from God, even one verse, even one letter, The one who says that the Torah is not from God, even one verse, even one letter, if one says Moses himself had written it on his own, he is a denier of the Torah. And he also adds, the one who denies Torah's interpretation and teachers like Tzadok and Baitus, who, you know, we discussed them in the politics of exclusion class, who reject rabbinic authority, and or God substituted one commandment for another. But notice that operative word there of hanimtzeit biyadenu, right? That thing of like the Torahs that we possess it today is no longer there. Two, there's an important distinction here between what someone believes, right, she'ne'emin, versus what someone says, she'omer. Mm-hmm. One is very internal, mm-hmm. the other is external. Mm-hmm. One could be something with which you are wrestling, mm-hmm. and the other is a declarative statement. Mm-hmm. It's one reason why I make a distinction personally between an atheist and an agnostic. Uh-huh. An agnostic is at least still searching, mm-hmm. right? Whereas an atheist has already made up his mind. Mm-hmm. Right? So that's a very important distinction there too. Another one that should be mentioned here, without mm-hmm. getting into the substance of the argument, is simply one of authority. And we discuss this mm-hmm. a lot in our Sunday class, mm-hmm. of, yes, Rambam says these, but where does it say that, you know, Rambam is either necessarily correct mm-hmm. or is, how to put it this way, halachically authoritative? In mm-hmm. particular, people really don't mm-hmm. follow Rambam with any sense mm-hmm. of consistency. Mm-hmm. It's one matter like, yes, the 13 Ikari Emunah, people seem to say it's like, oh, you absolutely positively have to mm-hmm. believe them. But also, I mean, one of the mm-hmm. sources I use for this is also in the bibliography, Mark Shapiro wrote, was it The Limits of Orthodox Theology? A lot mm-hmm. of people argued on a lot of Rambam's Ikari Emunah. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's not so definitive mm-hmm. that as a matter of halacha, these mm-hmm. are things that you actually have to do, because as you see, there seems to be a difference within Rambam. He wrote the Ikari Emunah as part of the Perush HaMishnah much mm-hmm. earlier in his life than Mishnah Torah, right? So it's quite possible he changed his mind, or he sort of softened things up a little.
So which one is earlier, 4 or 5?
4. The intro to Mishnah in Sanhedrin 10 is earlier than the Mishnah Torah. So it's possible he changed his mind, or possibly he refined it, but even right? There is no Sanhedrin that says, here's what you absolutely have to do. Mm-hmm. Right? But before we get that even further, mm-hmm. thinking about what does it mean to be an Ikar Emunah? Mm-hmm. The best explanation I mm-hmm. ever got from in terms of fundamental principle of faith was from mm-hmm. Professor Martin Riesbrot at the mm-hmm. University of Chicago Div School, where he explained a fundamental principle of faith, not so much as things that you have to believe, but things without which the religion does not make sense. Mm-hmm. Now, from that perspective, Rambam's statement makes a great deal of sense. Because what happens if you don't believe that the Torah that you have in your hands is from God? What happens then?
You're not going to care about the fundamental principles of it.
You're not going to care about any of it.
Definitely.
It's like, sure, like it might have, but it's very easy for you to say, well, once this Torah that we have in our Aron Kodesh isn't exactly from God, then what difference does anything mm-hmm. make? And it's also important to make that to stay on that point for a bit, mm-hmm. Because when you go back to debating mm-hmm. biblical criticism, mm-hmm. it's very easy to point out one argument or two arguments. But all you need is one argument to stay to show how the traditional model is implausible in order for it to fall to pieces. My father had a professor, Baruch Levine, who said you can't be half pregnant. Mm-hmm. Like, when you're talking about the Torah mm-hmm. from a fundamentalist perspective, in its totality all coming from God, mm-hmm. just one little hole in it and the whole thing can fall mm-hmm. apart in terms of your ideology. Mm-hmm. So it's really not so simple there. And that's just even dealing with, mm-hmm. you know, general questions about, you know, Rambam. Mm-hmm. We're going to, you know, discuss that a little bit mm-hmm. further, but it's very important to, you know, throw in number three, just mm-hmm. how dangerous some fundamentalists' approach can be mm-hmm. in terms of what other problematic things it can lead you to uh-huh. by overstating your case. Uh-huh. One, this particular thing happened to have not been mentioned by the VOD, but it is something that I've heard enough that it is worthwhile uh-huh. rebutting now, uh-huh. is the question, do you have to believe that the Torah in its entirety, 100%, was given specifically at Har Sinai? And the answer, in my opinion, is a flat-out no. Mm-hmm. And we're going to see some commentators, some other midrashim mm-hmm. like this, that idea is contradicted mm-hmm. not by Chazal, not by Rishonim, but by the Bible itself. Mm-hmm. Take verse number 6. This is the first verse in Devarim.
These are the words which Moses spoke to all Israel on the side of the Jordan in the wilderness, in the plain opposite Suf between Paran, Tophel, Laban, Hazarot, and Disabat.
Meaning, where was it not? At Har Sinai.
Yeah.
Now, some might want to argue that, oh, really, Moshe actually got all of this stuff, mm-hmm. but then you'd have to say, well, he kept it to himself for 40 years, mm-hmm. which is kind of like, what, for 40 years they didn't need all of Sefer Devarim? The other issue you have is later on, Devarim 29:69.
Okay. These are the words of the covenant which the Lord commanded Moses to make with the children of Israel in the land of Moab. besides the covenant which he made with them in Horeb.
Horeb. To be fair, neither Rambam nor the Vod uses the word Sinai.
I said that at the very beginning. Yeah. That was, like I said, that was not said by the Vod, and it's not mentioned by Rambam. Mm-hmm. The Vod is very consistent, or not very consistent, but it seems to me clear that the Vod got their statement from Rambam. They were poskening flat out Rambam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Now, do they posken Rambam for other things? I would assume no, or at least a whole lot of other things. They don't, but this they do.
Right.
Fine. But, and like I said, the idea that you have to believe that the Torah in its entirety was given at Sinai is contradicted by the Torah itself when it says, even if you don't want to say that first verse in Devarim, this verse at the end of the verse at the end of 29:69 about, here's the covenant that God told Moses to make with the Jewish people in Horeb, right? And they did this at Horeb, not at Har Sinai, shows that there's stuff happening afterwards. And another example could be the Benot Slavchad, which is after Moses came down from the mountain and had that whole thing with the daughters of Slavchad. I'd say, father died, we've got no, property, yada, 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 right? Stuff happened, right? God talks to Moses throughout the period. Now, that doesn't interfere with Moses at all, because the problem that, not Moses at all, that doesn't appear with Rambam at all, because you're still not saying that Moses made it up on his own, right? But you have to be careful with your fundamentalism, because when you overstate your case that is so easily refuted, and I try to be very careful with what it is that I cite to say, well, you must be wrong because, say, Ibn Ezra disagrees with you, isn't a legitimate proof because, well, who's Ibn Ezra? But when I say your fundamentalist statement contradicts the very book that you are trying to be a fundamentalist about, then it forces you to, it either forces you to backtrack or you have to say, well, the verses don't really mean what they say they mean, in which case you're really a selective fundamentalist. It's, you have to take things literally, except when they're inconvenient with my a priori ideology, in which case we need to do stuff. And I actually know of a particular rabbi who, when my father got into an argument with something, he cited a particular rabbi that changed, the text. Oh, he says, he doesn't read the verse this way. Oh, it was Hashem Hashem Lama Azavtani. Right, verse in Tehillim, my God, why have you forsaken me? And he said, so-and-so reads the text, Hashem Hashem Lima Azavtani. It's like, my God, for what have you forsaken me? And my father said, so you don't like the verse, you change it?
Well, except for Karais, Jews have never been, even the most ultra-right wing, I don't think, have ever been generally read the text consistently literally.
Right, but then if you're not going to read it that literally, you have to be... Okay, I shouldn't say you have to be because people aren't. If you're going to be even remotely convincing, you have to be honest with the statements you make. If you're not going to be consistent in your own reading, you cannot expect a uniform dogma for everything else, because then it's not going to work. It might mean you have to dial down your fundamentalism a bit to meet whatever facts that you have on the ground.
Right.
Okay? All right. So it was important to throw that point in again. I don't want to in any way assert that the Vod actually said that the Torah had to come from Sinai, because they didn't. It's just an important point that's to include now. Now, when we come to biblical criticism, some of the ideas that they have or that they try to address are what I would call difficult verses, right? Certain things that would pose problems for the interpreter, some of which, incidentally, we'll see in a bit, are actually addressed by the Gemara or by traditional sources, where they recognize these things pose a problem. Take number 8. This is Genesis 12:6.
Avram passed through the land to the place of Shechem as far as the terebinth tree of Moreh, and the Canaanites were then in the land.
Now, what's the problem with saying the Canaanites were there in the land?
Well,
were then in the land.
Yeah.
Not there in the land. Canaanites were then
in the land. Right.
What's
the
problem?
Well, it seems like you would think everything would be written as of the time.
Yeah, because if this would have been written, let's say the latest possible date according to the Torah, depending on how you read the verses, end of Sefer Devarim, that's when Moshe put it all together. Right. So why are you saying the Canaanites were then in the land? They're in the land right now, right? What happened there?
Right.
Ibn Ezra happens to give an answer to this, and he also says, if you don't buy this, know it's a secret, and the wise will keep their mouth shut. Meaning he's recognizing there's a problem, but he's not going to say so explicitly. This is one verse people will point to. Here's another one, Numbers 12:3.
Now the man Moses was very humble, more than all men who were on the face of the earth.
Right. So now this does not in any way challenge authorship, but it's one of those things that sounds very strange, where the most humble man on the earth is writing that he's the most humble man on the earth.
Sounds like a J-Date ad.
interesting. Probably the more, you know, well-known of all of these is actually addressed in the Gemara. And that's Devarim 34:5, Ve'amot Sham Moshe Eved Hashem. So this, Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab. Bava Batra 15a has the following. The master has said, Joshua wrote the book which bears his name, meaning the book of Joshua, and the last eight verses of the Pentateuch. This statement is in agreement with the authority who says that eight verses in the Torah were written by Joshua. As it had been taught, it is written, so Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there. Now, is it possible that Moses being dead could have written the words, Moses died there? I mean, look, even if he can get past, you know, the humility things, like, okay, fine, he admits that he's humble, right? How do you write that you died? The truth is, however, that up to this point, Moses wrote, from this point, Joshua wrote. This is the opinion of Rav Judah, or according to others, Rabbi Nechemiah. Said Rav Simon to him, can we imagine the scroll of the law being short of one word? And is it not written, take this book of the law? No, what we must say, it is up to this point, the Holy One, blessed be He, dictated, and Moses repeated and wrote. And from this point, God dictated, and Moses wrote with tears. As it says of another occasion, then Baruch answered him, he pronounced all these words with his mouth, and I wrote them with ink in the book. So here you have a very interesting dispute here, almost like one is, you know, holding on to this, you know, a fundamentalist type notion of Shimon, of like, can you imagine, like, it says, you know, l'koch et ha-sefer hazeh, it must be the entirety of the book. So he has to come up with, let's say, a more, I almost want to say convoluted type of answer, whereas the simplest answer, what they say, Occam's razor, which is the simplest answer, is mostly correct, is saying, well, yeah, sure, Joshua could have done that, right? And at least, you know, Rav Yehuda or Rav Nechemiah, depending on who you think this was, certainly didn't think it was heretical to offer that idea. Even if you want to say it's a machloket, it's a dispute.
Yeah.
The fact that they're both in Gemara, meaning if you want to call like me a kofer, like go ahead.
Yeah.
You want to call like, you know, Tanaim or Marim kofrim. Well, with the exception of Elisha ben Avuya, you really, you know, it's much harder to do that.
Yeah.
All right. This isn't the only opinion on this, by the way. Take 11a and 11b on Devarim 34:1, the very beginning of that chapter, followed by Ibn Ezra on it.
Then Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo, to the top of Pisgah, which is across from Jericho. And the Lord showed him all the land of Gilead as far as Dan.
Gilead.
And Ibn Ezra says, and Moshe went up. According to my view, this verse was written by Joshua, because after Moshe went up, he did not write, and this was written prophetically.
Right, because before he died, Moses went up to the mountain. Mm-hmm. Now, if you want to say that Moses writing this on the mountain, at what point did it say he went down? Mm-hmm. Meaning, if I'm up in the mountain, and I'm writing stuff, and I never go back down, how would the Jewish people have gotten the Sefer Torah?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So Ibn Ezra, right, and you know, people have issues with Ibn Ezra theologically too, but here he's offering a different opinion to the Gemara that is following a theology that's already been validated by the Gemara, but saying, if you're really going to get technical, the text makes more sense, not for the final eight verses, but from, you know, the beginning of the chapter. Now, does this in any way deny the divine origin of the Torah? No, but it's a way that they're trying to address a clear-cut problem while still maintaining within the tradition. Because it's still ultimately prophetically given, if not through Moshe, then through Joshua. Now here's where we get to the real meat of things. Remember the big, big problem that Rambam had, or at least that he even seemed to backtrack from in Hilchot Teshuvah, was the Torah that we have today. The problem with that statement is, what do you do with variants? Meaning, if you want to say that the Torah that we have today, in its exact form, is exactly what God gave us from Har Sinai, then it is absolutely impossible to tolerate any single deviation at all. Problem is, you got a bunch of them. And again, no tricks here, quoting straight Chazal. All right? First, Gemara Kedushin. Rav Joseph propounded, does the Vav of Gahon belong to the first half or the second half? Said they, the scholars to him, let a scroll of the Torah be brought, and we will count them. Did not Rabbah Bar Chana say, they did not stir from there until a scroll of the Torah was brought, and they counted them? They were thoroughly versed in the defective and full readings, but we are not. Defective in full here is how the Cencino translates chaser and yeterot, or what we call malay and chaser. Mm-hmm. There are certain words in the Torah that are written, let's say the u and the o sound, sometimes it has the placeholder vav, and sometimes it doesn't. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Same thing with an E sound. Sometimes it has a chirik, and sometimes it doesn't have a chirik. Mm-hmm. No, I'm sorry, that was wrong. Sometimes the chirik has a yud, sometimes it doesn't. Mm-hmm. Right? But if it's going to be all entirely from God, then how is that variant mm-hmm. even allowed?
Right.
Also, you should know that the very fact that it says here that we're not sure about the malays and chasers, mm-hmm. or the chaserot and yeterot, this passage alone shoots down the whole Bible code stuff in this one Gemara, actually the next one too. Mm-hmm. If you're familiar with the Bible codes, I should actually throw out a nice little aside mm-hmm. here on them. When they first started becoming popular, they came to my high school, JEC, mm-hmm. must have been 95.
Uh-huh.
And they were trying to build up support. This is when it was a brand new thing. And when they came, they said, we're not using this as a basis for faith. Mm-hmm. We're using this as a way to get people in the door so that we get them, give them the good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what the official policy line is, uh-huh. but since then people have been using it uh-huh. for faith. And it's based on certain types of codes and number uh-huh. jumping, number jumping of certain letters, which the amazing Randy, one of my favorite skeptics, mm-hmm. you know, debunked with like Moby Dick.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is, all you need is one extra yud, or an extra vav, or minus yud, minus a vav, and it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And you have no idea what was mm-hmm. truly authentic from God. Mm-hmm. We skipped you, sorry about that.
No problem.
Here's another important Gemara. This is Yerushalmi Ta'anit 4:2.
Okay. Three scrolls did they find in the temple courtyard. These were the
Ma'on
scroll dwelling, the Za'atuti.
Za'atui. Za'atuti, I'm sorry.
Za'atuti scroll, little ones. And the He scroll.
Mm-hmm.
In one of these scrolls, they found it written, "The Eternal God is our dwelling place, Ma'on." In Deuteronomy, the Eternal God. Then from Deuteronomy 33:27, "The Eternal God is your dwelling place, and underneath are the everlasting arms, and He thrust out the enemy before you and said, 'Destroy.'" End quote. And in two of the scrolls, it is written, "The Eternal God is your dwelling place."
Me'onah. Meaning one is Ma'on, and the other it says Me'on. They found three Sifrei Torah. Two had Ma'on, one had Me'onah. So they said, mm-hmm. right?
They confirmed the reading found in the two, huh. and abrogated the other.
Meaning, once they went by the majority. So, you know, for the two that had Ma'on, they said, you know what, we're going to do Ma'on, and what Ma'onah must be wrong, go by the majority. Go ahead.
One of them, they found written, "They sent the little ones of the people of Israel," Exodus 24:5, "and He sent young men of the people of Israel who offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen to the Lord." And in the two, it was written, they sent young men, etc. They confirmed.
Meaning one had Vishlachet Za'atuti b'nei Yisrael, and in two it says Vishlachet Na'are b'nei Yisrael. So that's not even, you know, the hey or not a hey, it's a completely different word.
Mm-hmm. They confirmed the two and abrogated the other. In one of them they found written, he written in the feminine spelling, 9 times, and in two they found it written that way 11 times.
Meaning there are a bunch of times in the Gemara, if anyone's ever tried learning Vayikra, it is a pain in the neck, say for Vayikra. They're often, the word he is written with a vav, meaning it's hey vav aleph, but it's pronounced he. There was someone in my father's old shul who pronounced all of his who's as he's. So in a way, as a Balkari, it's very useful if that's your dialect, because you don't have to worry about that learning Vayikra, and no one's going to correct you. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Okay. But either way, they confirmed the reading found in the two and abrogated the other.
Yeah. All right? So this is a really fascinating Gemara, because not only is it addressing textual variants amongst mm-hmm. different... I mean, unlike the first one where it's saying, well, we just don't know, here it's saying there were actually variants that existed. I mean, one Sefer Torah had it this way and two had it the other way.
Mm-hmm.
The other fascinating quirk about this is... independently, because of what each of the mm-hmm. other two did, mm-hmm. all three of the Sifrei Torah at the end were puzzle. If you think about it. Meaning, they came up with their conclusions by relying on three invalid Sifrei Torah, because two of them negated the third. And however you do the combinations, right, mm-hmm. that third one's going to be puzzle,
right.
but it was good enough to help prove why the other one, you know, would be puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a pretty big deal, especially when you consider that the entire Torah had to be 100% consistent, mm-hmm. right, as we have it. That's, again, the language mm-hmm. of the Rambam that the Vod picked up. And here are a bunch of phenomenal Midrashim. This is from Midrash Rabbah, which, Midrash Rabbah, of the books of Midrash Rabbah, is considered like it's one of the earlier ones, perhaps one of the more authentic ones. Mm. But what we're going to see here is that not so much of paskening out of Midrash Rabbah, meaning we're not using this as definitive fact as much as to say, if what this Midrash Rabbah says, you know, if we hold the Midrash Rabbah accountable to Rambam, mm-hmm. or according to the Vod, these Midrashim are kfira. I mean, there's a difference to say we don't rely on a Midrash, and another thing to say this actually contains heresy.
Mm-hmm.
What do I mean? So Genesis 1:31 says, "Then God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good." We're all familiar with that one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. Here's what it says in Genesis Rabbah 1:5. "In the Torah of Rav Meir, it was found to be written, and indeed it was very good, and indeed it was death." Now those are three words that don't quite appear there. Next, Genesis 3:21. "Also for Adam and his wife, the Lord God made tunics of skin, katanot, or with an ayin, ve'al b'shem, and he clothed them." In Genesis 20:12, we find in the Torah of Meir, it was found to be written tunics of light, meaning not or with an ayin, but or with an aleph. Nice little point here. Shulchan Aruch says that someone who cannot distinguish between the aleph and the ayin cannot be a shleach tzibur. And you see, in some cases, it does make a difference. Mm-hmm. Like this one, where Rav Meir had something else. And in Genesis 46:23, which says, "The children of Dan were Chushim, uvenei Dan Chushim." In Genesis 94:9 says, "In the Torah of Meir, it was found to be the child, uven Dan Chushim." So Rav Meir seems to have had his own Torah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of the distinctions might be insignificant. Maybe Ben Dan to Bnei Dan could be one of those Ma'alei Chaser things, meaning it could have been written Ben Dan, but he might have read it Bnei Dan, right? One of those Kriyuk Sif things.
Mm-hmm.
That one, okay, seems a little bit easier to live with. The Katanot, or and or? You know, that screams scribal error,
uh-huh.
right? Because not everyone distinguished them. In fact, the Gemara in Megillah the Gemara in the Megillah that makes the point off of which the Shulchan Aruch bases the halacha says people from certain towns can't daven for the Amud because those happen to have been places where there was greater assimilation. But the Netov Mavet, right? Mm-hmm. How do you randomly have that?
Indeed,
right?
It sounds like a fun guy, this Meir.
But this is Rav Meir,
yes.
right? So again, according to the Vod and according to Rambam, this is Kfira.
Mm-hmm.
So what did people do? When you find Rav Meir with a different Sefer Torah, what are you supposed to say? That you believe that the Torah that you have in your hands is from God when you've got two different things that people call the Torah?
Uh-huh.
Pretty, pretty big deal. Take the Igrot Moshe 3:114. This is in a certain this was written March 30th, 1976, and he's in fact describing here discussing the halacha. According to the Rama, based on the Gemara in Kiddushin, you don't pasul a sefer Torah over a male and a chaser. According to Rambam, you do. Any letter is off, Pasul Sefer Torah. According to Rama, because the Gemara says we are not experts with the defective or full versions, meaning with the Vav or without the Vav, with the Yod or without the Yod, you can't pasul it because we don't know for sure. Here's how Rav Moshe here's what Rav Moshe writes in Yeridaya 3:114.
"And thus no person, not even a prophet, to remove even one letter. And if one letter is missing or one error is added, it is invalid as explained through in Rambam's Hilchot Sefer Torah. But since we are not experts in the defective or full writings as we find in Kiddushin 30, the validity of our Torah scrolls is not so certain."
That is amazing. "En kashrut sefrei Torah shalanu berura kol kach." The validity of our Torah scrolls is not so certain. And this is Rav Moshe Feinstein.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are you going to say Rav Moshe Feinstein is a kofar? Would the Vod of Toronto say that he's a kofar? Because effectively, this statement here is almost like, yes, the Rambam says what the Rambam says in Shmoneh Parakim. Now, how would you handle this? You got to call Rav Moshe a kofar if you're going to be a strict fundamentalist according to Rambam. That's a pretty, pretty big deal. Mm-hmm. Now, if they want to take out Rav Moshe, they're more. But look, again, make up Rav Moshe Feinstein's phrase. En kashrut sifrei Torah shelanu b'rura kol kach. We don't know. Mm-hmm. And once you say that you don't know, it gets really hard to say you have to believe that this came from God in its exact pristine form that you're holding in your very hands. Mm-hmm. All right.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. Yeah.
Okay. I wanted to include here now two possible approaches for reconciliation. Now, as you can imagine, there's been a great deal of religious scholarship on this, not just from Jews, but also Christians as well. It's one of the reasons why there's so much written on the Bible. Yes, I'm sorry for those listening if you hear habanera in the background. We have a Russian art theater group performing Chekhov, and I think they're rehearsing upstairs. Anyway. There are a lot of agendas that come up here, and I think one of the sensitivities to biblical criticism goes back to the Haskalah. And there were certain Reform Jews would actually use biblical criticism itself as a religious polemic against the Orthodox, meaning as a way to say, oh yeah, this proves like the whole thing is just nonsense and we can do what we want, which sort of requires the other side to double down. You did have some traditionalists that did try, that did try, appeasing certain things. And this is from, I didn't have time to, really amass primary quotes. Things are all in the bibliography, which we can look at. But a scholar, Baruch Schwartz, wrote an article, The Pentateuch as Scripture and the Challenge of Biblical Criticism, in which he actually goes through a very nice survey over, what were some of these reactions. And I included two that I think are of particular import. I'd like to do them. I quoted them here as he wrote it, but I'd like to do them out of order. Okay? So could you read the second paragraph?
Sure. Another attempt to admit Pentateuchal criticism without embracing reform or denying revelation was made by David
Halivni. Ever heard the name? Rav David Weiss Halivni.
Okay.
Recently retired to Israel.
A European-born scholar who spent most of his career in the United States. He suggested that a written Torah was in fact dictated to Moses, but that it as is amply evident from biblical, historical, and rabbinical tradition, was not accepted as binding by the Jews until the early Second Temple period under Ezra. In the time intervening, postulated Halivni, the text had become flawed, so that the Torah that Ezra inherited and that he and his successors, the early sages, were to implement was not identical to the one given to Moses.
Right. So in this way, he actually gets, he gets the best of all worlds. One of the things with the documentary hypothesis is, you have the four traditions, and you all said R, a redactor that put it all together. In a sense, Halivni, this is in a book called Revelation Restored. He kind of argues that Ezra's, the grand redactor, and then everything works, right? And to argue that, say, the Jews didn't really accept the Torah, well, reading through, Nevi'im, they really didn't do a good job, the Jews. I mean, they kept worshiping idols, kept doing a whole lot of other stuff they shouldn't do, really didn't listen to many of the prophets. So this is his approach about how, all right, what do you think? Do you find this convincing, unconvincing? I mean, it's hard to say, do you find it convincing? Because unless you know the biblical scholarship, it's hard to figure to really say, does this necessarily work? So let's focus on it from, let's say you assume all of the the academic biblical, I want to say content as opposed to the narrative, because part of the narrative of the this allows you to do some of the historical stuff too, in terms of certain things were written or amended over time. Right, but let's say from an the theological standpoint, do you think this works for you? Do you think this doesn't work?
Well,
are you comfortable with this?
I don't know.
That Ezra basically put it all together.
Right, I mean, it's kind of weird to say that they didn't fully accept it. I don't know. It, to me, like,
Well, accept it as binding by Jesus. Yeah, I mean, that's a very psychological statement to make. You could still accept it as binding and not do it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
Okay.
Right. I don't know. That's what I find a little off.
What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's very hard to know. The problem is, you know, what the prophets say, we get such a incomplete picture of what went on during those 500 years. It's really very hard to know what people accepted and what they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my guess is that, you know, if you have all this first temple, presumably it's based more or less on the Torah. But who knows? But certainly, I do find it easy to believe that people weren't able to keep it immaculate over 500 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, you have also Nevi writes about, you know, after the time of Menashe, they found the Sefer Torah there, so what were they doing until then?
Right.
You know, there's certainly, you know, maybe, you know, necessary room for error. The other, you know, advantage to this is you can still, you know, hold on to the other parts that Rambam would say are obligatory, at least, if not what was said in the Shmona Prakim, which we said is incredibly difficult for practical reasons, what he said in Hilchot Teshuvah, which is, yes, Moshe Rabbeinu did in fact get the Torah from God, and he got it in a pristine form. What we have today is not the pristine form, right? Now, that is the ultimate argument that is, I think, driving you know, Halivni, even if the actual details may or may not hold up, right? And so you can, I mean, and it's important to make that distinction there, meaning you can read Halivni and be unconvinced by the details and say, well, could it really been Ezra? You're overreading this, underreading that. Mm-hmm. But the essence of the argument is believing that God gave the Torah to Moshe, it just so happens that the book that we have in front of us isn't exactly what he had. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, that solves pretty much, you know, it can solve the biblical criticism issues because you're going through the book that you have. Mm-hmm. Does it solve your theological problems? Well, in part, meaning you're going to solve the, as a matter of halakha, right, based on Rambam, fine, but as a matter of an ikar emunah, it raises the question, well, if this isn't what God actually said, then why are you doing it?
Right. The theological problem is worse.
Meaning, well, I wouldn't say worse as much as it
not
shifts.
Approved.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Right, yeah. I don't want to quantify, like, what makes a better or stronger argument.
Right, yeah.
It's just you're substituting one question for another.
Right, yes, yes.
So go back up to the first paragraph or that I quote here is one of the very, only in recent periods have more serious attempts been made. The Israeli Orthodox philosopher Yeshayahu Leibowitz, and I know, oh, I should also point out here that there are quite a few in the Orthodox world who will not consider either Halivni or Leibowitz to be Orthodox.
Mm-hmm, right.
Right? And it could very well be for the very, these statements are the ones I said early on, where if you don't meet a prayer, a certain rigid set of criteria, we don't consider you Orthodox.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a loaded term, and it's important to mention now. Anyway, he argued that the commitment to Jewish belief and practice was independent of any theory with regard to the origin of the written Torah, since the former depends entirely on the acceptance of the authority of the classical rabbinic sages. The Torah text that they canonized is religiously relevant only as implemented by them. Earlier stages in Israel's religious development evidenced in the Bible are irrelevant and can either be studied or ignored without influencing traditional piety. So this, you know, solves the other problem, which is, well, what do you do with the God stuff? And the answer is kind of simple. To be an Orthodox Jew today, you don't follow biblical Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
You follow rabbinic Judaism. Mm-hmm. You don't follow, I think you said this at the very beginning, you don't follow the literal text of the Bible. That would make you a Karaite.
Mm-hmm.
You're following the tradition of the rabbinic sages.
Mm-hmm.
So almost if you put, you know, the two ideas together, it's a way of how do you remain being a frum Jew, being an honest frum Jew, while also not hiding your head in the sand with whatever evidence, be it archaeological, be it textual, be it anything that comes out of biblical criticism or the linguistics of or things that might otherwise contradict what is actually said. All right? So, I mean, you can take this, you can leave this as, does the solution work for you or does this not work for you? In terms of emunot v'deot, right, the core issue that comes up is believing that the text of the Torah that we have in our hands today is from God, which is something that is seems to be rejected from the Gemara, and, you know, also seem to be tacitly rejected by Rav Moshe Feinstein. And I'm not going to go through who says, you know, what or who doesn't. That's actually Mark Shapiro in his book, The Limits of Orthodox Theology, spends a whole chapter. It's a wonderful book because when he goes through each of, you know, the disputes on the 13 principles of faith, you know, he has a bunch of this stuff in that chapter. And I'll even cite more people that will disagree with that point of as we have it today. Once you free yourself from that particular doctrine that the Torah as we have it today is in its exact form what God gave, you know, to Moshe, then you have a little bit more room to play with to say, well, this might not necessarily be from God, but it still represents divine will, which is also incidentally how I phrased it in the whatchamacallit, the fundamentals of Judaism class, that the primary, that today, like approaching it from the fundamentals that like I defined earlier from Martin Riesbrod is, does the Torah represent divine will or not? Meaning, this came from God in some way, shape, or form. Do you need to be obsessed with the details of, like, well, how exactly did God give it? One of the greatest ironies of this is, you know, if you take the Torah at its very most fundamental level of, like, this came from God, what does God want you to do? Right? He says, believe in God. Fine. Do what I say. God, to my knowledge, in nowhere in the Bible says, you must believe everything in the Torah happened literally. Right? You just have to believe this is my will and this is what you should be doing. Right? So, you know, it's kind of interesting there. And I threw in here as a little appendix an example of comparative scholarship in that, you know, people will often get very scared off by anything called biblical criticism or even anything that smacks of it. Professor Rabbi Dr. Moshe Bernstein, who recently just got a named chair at Yeshiva University, teaches a class in NYU called Intro to Bible. It's a required class, and there are quite a few yeshiva and semine in Israel who warn students in Stern NYU about a particular kofar and not to take him, even though all of his sources were traditional. And as you notice from the sources that I cited, everything was traditional. I try to focus on Gemara as much as possible. But the unfortunate thing is, when you throw out everything, or at least, I mean, didn't even get to the point of, like, studying things that might be heretical, right? Which I should actually mention now. Can you? The answer seems to be yes, if you can get something good out of it. So the example I give for here is, in order to get on the Sanhedrin, you needed to be what the Gemara calls a Baal Keshafim, right? You need to be an expert in witchcraft. Why? Because if you're going to judge witchcraft, like, you know, cases of witchcraft, you have to know what you're talking about. So there are times where you actually do have to study things that might be considered heretical, not to mention there are also a whole bunch of useful tools. And in particular, there are certain things that you can find from external sources that help inform our reading of the Torah. And I just want to cite one example because I came across this when I was in high school. So Devarim 14:1-2 says, you are the children of the Lord your God. You shall not cut yourselves nor shave the front of your head for the dead. For you are a holy people to the Lord your God, and the Lord has chosen you to be a people for himself, a special treasure above all the people on the face of the earth. Now this is a pretty eloquent flourish for just don't cut yourself for dead people, right? Because you're treasured to God. Now, in a book by Coogan, Michael David Coogan, called Stories from Ancient Canaan, he has the following passage in one of the Baal tablets. Baal, you might recognize the name of that god if you're a Bible fan. We arrived at the lovely place, the desert pasture, at the beautiful fields on death's shore. We came upon Baal. He had fallen to the ground. Baal the conqueror has died. The prince, the lord of the earth, has perished. Then El, the kind, also El, by the way, important to note that too. The kind, the compassionate, came down from his throne, sat on his stool, came down from his stool, sat on the ground. He poured dirt on his head in mourning, dust on his skull in lamentation. He covered his loins with sackcloth. Money quote. He cut his skin with a stone, made incisions with a razor. He cut his cheeks and chin, raked the lengths of his arms. He plowed his chest like a garden. He raked his back like a valley. When you say, you know, you put these two things together, right, be a treasured nation for God and don't cut yourself for the dead, and you see in the Canaanite, you know, religion that was clearly a thorn in the side of the Jewish people, they actually did this sort of thing, right? Doing this comparative stuff can certainly enhance, you know, what we read in the Torah and to see, well, why were these important? What did this mean? Certainly, does this negate halacha in any way, shape, or form? No, but it does give you some, I think, really important insights every now and again. So hopefully, you know, this, again, I didn't want to give a full summary of biblical criticism. That would be impossible for me, not only because it's not my field, but we have, you know, an hour, give or take. And, you know, there, you could spend many, many, many years in graduate school just trying to figure all this stuff out. But the point was to try to come up with, well, first the point was to try to understand, well, what are some common arguments made and what are some difficulties with them, or at least the bigger problems. And it, truthfully, it's the bigger, how to put this? It's the most simplistic answers are the ones that have the most difficulty because they just don't fit. Unfortunately, those are the ones that are argued with the most passion and fervor. And we've seen how they don't match up based on traditional sources, either based on the Bible or the Talmud, what we call the Torah Sheba'al Peh. We saw a couple of modern-day attempts at resolutions from people who at least thought themselves to be observant Jews, while also understanding the scholarship. Whether or not this convinces you, either as an academic or as a from Jew, you know, I leave up to, you know, you or the listeners, you know, that's going to be a matter of subjectives. Whether or not you think believing any of this makes you a heretic is also up for discussion as well. And some people, again, would just say, no, it doesn't matter what, again, as a matter of polemic. But realize that, you know, putting people in chayrim and ostracizing them completely is really, it's not such a simple matter. And if you constantly do, like, you know, the knee-jerk reactionary stuff, you're going to wind up in, you know, other problems and perhaps pushing people away even further. So, you know, I'm not going to paskin the menot v'deyot. I'm not going to paskin what it is that you have to or don't have to believe. But we'll always be open to having any conversation you may have. A wonderful day.